This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The gender breakdown is essentially equal among Vermont high school students taking advanced placement tests in calculus, chemistry, and biology. But by the time you get to the end of college, young women are a minority of the students earning degrees in physics, chemistry, computer science, economics, and engineering. This despite the fact that women in the U.S. make up more of the population of enrolled students than men. It's significant because the jobs that engineering, computer science, and economics graduates get after college tend to be in higher-paying fields, and women are significantly underrepresented in higher-paying fields. In fact, 43% of Vermont women who work full-time do not make enough to cover basic living expenses. That's almost half. The Change the Story campaign is working hard to reverse these trends and to change the statistics to ensure economic stability and well-being for women and for their families. They've just released the second in a series of reports on women and wages. It's called Where Vermont Women Work and Why It Matters. Change the Story is an initiative driven by three statewide organizations, the Vermont Women's Fund, the Vermont Commission on Women, and Vermont Works for Women. And we're joined now by two of the leaders of those organizations, Carrie Brown, Executive Director of the Vermont Commission on Women, and Meg Smith, Director of the Vermont Women's Fund. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
So, Carrie Brown, you've put out two reports now of four that the Change the Story campaign has, and one of them is Women Work and Wages in Vermont, and the other one is Where Vermont Women Work and Why It Matters. And you're calling these status reports. So why is it important to have status reports and data when we start talking about the economic well-being of women in this state?
Well, we really need to know where we are to know what changes we have to make and what improvements we have to make. And this was envisioned initially as a comprehensive look at women's economic status right now, where we are right now. And it was originally designed to be one report. And as we got more into the data and found more information, we realized that we couldn't do any of it justice with just one report. So we've split it up into four, and we're kind of taking our time with it so we can really go into depth with it. And we need to know, I think there's a common understanding that women aren't making as much money as men are. But as far as the specifics, we didn't necessarily know what that really looked like in Vermont. And so in order to know how to make some changes, we need to know where we actually stand.
And so that data was out there. It just wasn't being analyzed by anybody?
For the most part, we found all this data. Some of it took a lot more digging than others. And some of it was readily available through state channels and some was really not. And so that's also part of what we're looking at is how can we make this data more accessible so that it doesn't involve a giant research project to find it in the future.
I'm curious about what was readily available and what wasn't. What took the digging?
Well, we had to get into microdata in the U.S. Census, and that is something that you really have to kind of know what you're doing to get into it and look at it. The Vermont Department of Labor has some basic information about wages and earnings in Vermont, and so we could start there. But when we wanted to look at real specifics about occupations, for instance, we don't track that in Vermont. And so we had to go look at the national data. And through the national data, we can get the Vermont numbers, but we're not actually gathering it in Vermont.
So you've employed some people, presumably some women, in some STEM fields here trying to get the data and crunch the numbers and do all of that in getting this to work.
That's right. That's right. We've been fortunate to be able to hire women who are experts in this and be able to do this research for us.
So Meg Smith, give us the overview then, and we're going to get into some of the specific numbers here and some of why this matters, and especially I'm curious about the types of jobs and careers that women are going into and why that is so important. That's really the focus of this second report. But big picture, how are women doing in Vermont?
Big picture, there's a lot of room for movement for women to improve. And that's what this data is showing. I want to take one step back and just explain the collaboration that got this initiative going, because what really made it exciting and powerful was that we took three statewide organizations, Carrie Brown being the director of the Vermont Commission on Women, which is a state agency, Vermont Works for Women, which is a nonprofit organization that has many programs teaching women job skills in non-traditional fields as well as traditional, and the Vermont Women's Fund, which is a philanthropic organization. We are a component fund of the Vermont Community Foundation. And it represents policy and program and philanthropy. The three of us together found that and decided with very, very little discussion that this was an absolute fit. We serve different audiences. So in collaborating, saying, let's take this idea of Change the Story, which is led by Tiffany Bloomley, who used to be the director of Vermont Works for Women, but I have to say she was perhaps the brainchild behind this, or certainly the motivator, that we decided how are we going to look at women and working in Vermont and what's going on. So that collaboration was the foundation and a very powerful one. Powerful to us in sparking ideas and thinking, how do we do this and where do we get the data? And also how we move forward and how we tell our story, because we want everybody to hear our story, because once you have information, it can really change attitudes and enhance understanding. So with that, how are we doing? We're finding, I mean, as Carrie said, when 43% of women working full-time are not meeting their basic needs, that's a big problem. Women who are single-parent households are 9 times more likely to live in poverty. And perhaps one of the big surprises for me was the state of elderly women. As we're a growing population to begin with, women live longer. They do not have the same Social Security benefits in their later years as their male counterparts because often weren't working. And we're going to have a lot of older women who are in need and will be relying on more state subsidies. And we need to address that and think about that right now and be moving ahead for the future.
In fact, when it comes to that Social Security payout, women are likely to have an average of about $10,000 a year. Is that right? And
$10,000
typically have 20.
Yes, it's half, and that's actually one of the areas where we're doing much worse than the national average. Our wage gap overall is a bit better than the national average. Women in Vermont make about 84% of what men make, which is a little bit better than the rest of the country. But as far as elderly women go, we're much worse off. We have a big problem already and looming.
And that's because women were either working in lower wage jobs through their careers or were not working as much as men. And the Social Security payout is tied to your salary and to how long you've been working and to what you were making. So that's
right.
Where that comes from?
Yes. And that's one of the reasons why the wage gap is a really big problem. It's not just how much money people are making at any moment, but over the course of a lifetime, you're not putting as much money into Social Security. You're not putting as much money into unemployment insurance, retirement savings, and all of those things which by the end of a lifetime have a huge impact.
We're talking today about the status of women in Vermont, the economic status of women, and looking at initiatives that are designed to help improve the economic status of women. And if you have thoughts on how to address the wage gap issue, the higher likelihood of women to live in poverty, and why women aren't going into or staying in the higher paying fields that are dominated by their male counterparts, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. You'll also be able to watch the show right now live on Facebook. We are streaming, so you can see what we all look like if that's your thing. You know, it's radio. It's not my thing, but it may be yours. So if it is, you can go to our Facebook page and watch the show today as we have this conversation with Carrie Brown and Meg Smith. And let's go to Naomi, who's calling in from Moncton. Hi, Naomi. Go right ahead.
Hi. I wanted to say that I'm an adjunct faculty member at Champlain College, and we get paid very little. I get just over $22,000, and I've been working there for almost 10 years. So I do not get compensated at all for holding a master's degree. Plus, I have student loans. And I would add to that, though adjuncts are both genders, they tend to be predominantly women who are adjuncts. So there's a myth that if you get enough education, you'll be paid well. And I am living proof that that's not true.
Naomi, how do you feel like that affects your life? You know, going beyond just the actual dollar figures, what does that mean for you in your life?
Well, I don't teach in the summer, so I'm on food stamps. Even during the winter when I am teaching, it's a struggle every day to pay the bills and to, you know, just do the ordinary things that a lot of people do. And I had really believed that when I got a master's degree, I would no longer live in poverty.
Well, Naomi, thanks for sharing your story and what you see as one of the issues and as a living embodiment of the issues. I appreciate your call. Thank you for calling in. We also got a note from Allison, who posted on our Facebook page to say, I'm a Winooski resident and a server at a very busy, prominent downtown eatery. Tuesday nights, like last night, are always our corporate business dinner night. I looked around the dining room, and I kid you not, 90% of the patrons seated were male. So noticeable was the demographic of white males in the room that every one of my colleagues commented on it at some point in the evening. And Allison says, come on, Vermont businesses, hire some women. What do you think of that, Carrie Brown?
Well, I think if you start looking for things like that, you're going to see patterns like that all over the place. And I just wanted to kind of affirm what Naomi, the caller, said, which is that we see this difference in earnings at every single education level. So we tell people, get more education, which, of course, is a good idea, but it doesn't erase that wage gap. And so the question about what businesses can do is a great one. And this is part of what the Change the Story Initiative is working on. We have a group called the Business Peer Exchange, which brings together employers to share practices that they're already doing and learn from each other and learn about how they can do things like increase the number of women on their boards. We know that businesses with gender diversity on their corporate boards perform better. And so it's in their interest.
Perform better in what metrics?
They make more money. The nice, simple metrics that we can all understand.
So it's worth their while to have women on the board because it's actually more profitable.
Exactly. Exactly. And then overall, this is what we're trying to show with these reports that we're doing, is that it's not just a matter of fairness and equity. It's really about the Vermont economy. And we need everyone's participation, and we need everyone fulfilling their full potential to benefit all of us.
You mentioned the Business Peer Exchange as one of the things that you're doing with Vermont businesses to try to make sure that they are looking at gender in their own workforce and in how to address these issues. And we have one of the businesses that you're working with on the line with us now. Joe Fusco is Vice President of Casella Waste Systems. Hi, Joe. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, good afternoon.
So can you tell us a little bit about what Casella is doing with this program and how you work as a business peer exchange?
Well, I certainly, from a personal level, enjoy participating in that exchange. It's not an issue that I have given a lot of thought to through most of my career. So I appreciate the opportunity to learn and grow and I would reinforce everything Carrie said earlier, make our business more competitive. I am not coming to this issue as any wonderful or great feminist or someone looking purely through the lens of gender. For me and for our business, this is purely a business competitive issue. And I think it's a business competitive issue not only for all the enterprises in Vermont, but for the entire economy of Vermont. No business worth its weight in salt can afford to ignore, discourage, or otherwise impair the talents, energy, and problem-solving ability of anyone, let alone a significant population such as women. So we see it as, in a competitive environment where you need all the talent and creativity you can get your hands on, how can we unlock those talents of women? How can we attract that creativity and talents to our business? And I think Vermont can ask that question of itself as a whole as well. And that's why we're interested.
So what have you been doing so far? I mean, and what are you seeing come from it?
You know, for me, it's been I would call myself pretty much a kindergartner in this area. So for me, it's sitting and listening to other businesses. It's sitting to listening to people like Tiff Bloomley and others talk about the things that you may not even know you're doing as a business, as a leader, as a business manager, unconsciously to impair or otherwise discourage women in your business from doing the best that they can do for you. So for me, it's been kind of sitting and thinking and watching our culture, watching how we do business, watching how we treat people, and saying, what are we doing and what can we do to be a better business?
Joe Fusco is Vice President of Casella Waste Systems. Thank you so much for calling in. We appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
So, Meg Smith, you know, there's one example of a business that's saying, all right, we're ready to listen. We're ready to learn. What are you hoping to push businesses into doing exactly?
Well, I think Joe captured it really well. A lot of it is just thinking about it for the first time, acknowledging, understanding when we talk about a gender lens, it does not mean that you have to do a wholesale change of your business practices. It's really stopping and taking a look and thinking, how, if we want more women in our business, how do we attract them? What kind of language do we use in our HR practices, in the want ads that go out in the paper, in our job descriptions? There's a very interesting nuance to wording that, as was described to me by VEIC, Vermont Energy Investment Corporation, that they found that when they put the word technical in a job description, that seemed to attract more men than women candidates. When they used the word digital, that more women candidates applied. I can't tell you why that is, but that those realities, those very small steps, are something we can all embrace. Another good example was a firm that realized when they looked on their website, it was a male-dominated firm, that there was not one picture of a woman on their website. So those are subtle, and yet they're really easy fixes. So I think that makes this discussion much more accessible to people. We are not wagging our fingers at people saying, you should do this, you should do that. It's more like, hey, let's all collectively sit and think how we can engage more women, help them rise up into these better paying jobs, and really take a good look at how we can improve our practices.
But that sounds easy, and yeah, that sounds like something any company can agree to. Oh, sure, I'm happy to mm-hmm. listen. I'm happy to talk about this. I'm happy to change the word technical yeah. to digital and add some pictures of the couple of women I have on staff. That's not hard, but that's not necessarily going to change things significantly for women or for women who are raising kids and have schedules that are not as flexible as perhaps their male counterparts, or maybe men are in this situation these days too. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there is going to be some hard stuff for companies if they actually want to make some changes, right? I mean, you said not wholesale, but are going to be changes.
I'm approaching it with a soft approach first, so that this idea does not make people turn and run away. But yeah, there are definitely deeper issues that we have to address. I mean, daycare has been an issue from the beginning of time of work, women working. That is still a big nut to crack. But I do think that you have to first engage people and get them on board to say, hey, yeah, okay, let's look at this a little bit with maybe some of these softer approaches. But getting deeper into wage issues and particularly women in management and women in upper management and women on boards, that is a very important step. And that does have to come from the top down. And so I am and my optimistic feeling is that we have a lot of really great leaders in business here in Vermont that are willing to take a look at that. Joe is a perfect case in point.
Carrie Brown, do you take the soft touch too?
Well,
you're allowed to not.
I agree that this is a great place to start, but I do also think that when we step back, we have to look at the overall culture of work, and we have to look at how families and work combine, because families are changing and the workplace is not necessarily keeping up with that. And this is true for men as well as for women. More and more men are needing to balance their family responsibilities with their work responsibilities. And it's very hard for them in different ways than it's hard for women. And I think that a lot of women are making choices about jobs based on assumptions about how they're going to have to care for their family, for their children, or for their aging parents, that may or may not necessarily be true, but they're looking for flexibility and they're making decisions based on that are having an impact on their earnings and on their career trajectories.
And I want to say, I mentioned women there as specifically an issue because we know that still women are the primary caregivers for their children and often carry, as you said, for aging parents, although we are seeing more of a sharing of the load and more men taking on that responsibility. It still disproportionately falls to women to be the ones who are primary caregivers for children. And so it's even more of an issue for women on that issue of flexibility or scheduling caring or making sure that they're able to care for children while also holding down a job. We're talking today about women, work, and wages in Vermont, and you can share your perspective or ask a question. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or on our webpage at vpr.net. Both places you can also watch the show today as we live stream it. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit more about this issue of, I guess you could call it the career gap, and women going into lower paying careers and lower paying fields. And why is that, and what can we do to adjust that or to encourage women to go into and stay in higher paying wage jobs? You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today, we're looking at newly compiled data that attempts to paint a more complete picture of women's wages and careers in Vermont. We're talking with Carrie Brown, Executive Director of the Vermont Commission on Women, and Meg Smith, Director of the Vermont Women's Fund. If you'd like to share your story, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page where we're streaming the show live today. Let's go to Brady calling in from Killington. Hi, Brady. Go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi.
First of all, hi to Carrie Brown. We were on a committee about women in technology at Vermont Tech when I was a student there, and she was a teacher.
Hi, Brady. I remember you.
Uh-oh.
That was ancient history.
I'm sure you do. So my first comment is that a whole bunch of the pay gap in Vermont goes away if they raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, because that'll hit the reset button on about 45% of the low-wage earners in Vermont. And everybody will be earning the same amount. Second comment is, I went into technology. I worked with IBM. There were lots of women there who were excellent high performers in technology, but it was overworked. There were not enough degreed women.
Brady, we're losing your line there. I'm sorry that you're going in and out, but I think we've got the gist of what you're saying. First of all, your support of raising the minimum wage to $15, which would raise everybody in those lower paying jobs and presumably many women in those fields. But also Brady's getting into, and we didn't get to hear all of it, but this idea of the STEM fields and women who may be starting out, and I'm not sure where he was going with that, but maybe aren't attaining the higher levels, which is something that we see in STEM fields. That, you know, as you point out in your reports, at least in high school, girls and boys are sort of equal in terms of who's taking advanced placement courses, these college-level courses in STEM fields. And then it just continues to glide off significantly for where women are going in those fields and if they continue to stay in them. So pick up where Brady left off, because we didn't get to hear more of what he was saying. Carrie Brown?
Yeah, that's a really interesting dynamic that we need to look a lot more into, the way we see more girls in high school taking these higher-level math and science courses than they used to. More young women going to college. We have more young women in college now than we do men. And yet, when they are coming out, we're still seeing very similar results. So in one of the things that we found in our latest report was we looked at where women were working in the 70s and where they're working now. And the similarities were striking. Women are still going into office clerical work and becoming nurses and those kinds of things, the same things they were doing in 1970. Engineering is a great example of one where there were no women in engineering, no measurable, in 1970, and now it's about 15% women. In the 80s, there was a surge of women going to college and becoming engineers, and the numbers were higher than that, and then it dropped off. And so we're seeing it's not just a matter of women going into these fields, it's staying in as well. And that's another really tough nut to crack.
So what do we do about that, Meg Smith? I mean, one of our web developers here at VPR messaged me this morning and said, you know, for me, it's not so much the issue of telling girls it's great to go into the STEM fields, it's how do you keep them in here? And women who may not want to be in a bro-y field that doesn't seem to welcome them once they get into it and doesn't seem to want to see them succeed. So how do we adjust that?
I wish I had the answer for you, Jane. I think one of the things we've learned in our research in past and present is that when young women in their teenage years get a sense of what their career opportunities are. That gives them a broader perspective. But that is not really the answer. That's just one thing that they need to know. In the STEM fields particularly, I read a study I thought was fascinating that when young women can make the link between the sort of technical stuff they're learning and something that has a greater social impact, i.e., if they are learning what they're learning might be an answer to the water quality issue, then they are much more interested in pursuing that more technical degree than if it is just kind of in isolation or if it's just being put to use in a very sort of dry way. Women seem to need to have that social impact umbrella to motivate them. But, you know, as Carrie said, this is a tough nut to crack. It's going to take some while to figure out why are women not sticking in those STEM fields.
Let's go to Lynn calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Lynn. You're on.
Hi, there you are.
Here we are.
I am so thrilled that you're putting this on the air. Anything you touch, Jane, is exciting to me, and I'd be happy to look at you on Facebook, but I'm not at a computer. So I actually have been thinking about this for a long time. I used to work in the trades as a carpenter laborer many years ago, actually in the 70s, and I was trying to raise a young kid at the time who was in foster care with me, and that was the biggest problem. Truly, I was the only woman on the job, so there was harassment for sure, but there was also some very wonderful supportive men who started teaching me the trade, and I loved it. But having to be on a job site at 7 in the morning is impossible for a single parent, and that is one of the biggest reasons that I had to leave the trade. So I'm encouraging people who are thinking about businesses' investment and real welcome to the diversity of workers, potential workers, to think about shifts in such traditional work as the skilled construction trades, because it's fabulous work, it's interesting work, it's dynamic relational work, but it's closed to women as long as the job is 7 to 3 or 7:30 to 3:30. And there's no reason for it because the contractors and inspectors were on the job site easily till 5 every day.
Lynn, thank you so much for sharing your perspective and your story. I appreciate hearing it. Let's get another call in here from Mark in South Hero. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to connect to a couple of things. One, My overall point is, I work in early intervention, by the way, which is not typically a male field by any stretch. There are two of us in my office, and everyone else is a woman. And we're all paid, by the way, equally at Vermont Family Network for the work that we do. What we have found is that anyone working with children, whether it's in early intervention or in child care, which was mentioned as a need, quality child care, and we get that request from parents all the time, where can I find quality child care for my child who has special needs, by the way, is anyone working in any field dealing with children, young children in particular, is underpaid. We have people who are highly qualified on staff with master's degrees, sometimes multiple master's degrees, who are paid a pittance for the work that they do it because they need the flexibility, because they love the work with families and children, they're dedicated to it, but they're not paid what they should be, and that's a problem. We should structure the workplace for both men and women so that if you're passionate about working with families and children, whether you're a man or a woman, you can afford to do that. And likewise, the people receiving that service can count on having qualified people doing that work because it pays enough that qualified people do the work.
Mark, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. And, you know, Carrie Brown, you were talking earlier about looking at where women work today in Vermont and how similar it is to 40 years ago. And often these are the lower earning job sectors. What about Mark's point that maybe that's what we should be working on as well, is making sure that those sectors aren't the low wage earning sectors, that people, especially who are working with young children or in education, are making enough money to do the job that they're passionate about.
Yes, I'm really glad that he called and brought up that point, because we have to ask why it is that women are going into fields that pay less. Why are they clustering? But we also have to ask, why are those fields where women tend to cluster paid less? And he gives a perfect example. I can't think of anything, any work that's more valuable than working with children. And I don't know who would disagree with that statement. And yet it is one of the lower paid by a lot fields that we have. And we have seen some evidence that when more men get into jobs that are traditionally done by women, the wages tend to go up. It works the other way, too. More women go into jobs that men have held, the wages tend to go down. But so this might be an area where if we were a little bit more gender balanced in childcare and work with children and families, that maybe we would see the value of that go up monetarily. I would hope so. But I think that's an absolutely crucial question to ask, is why is it paid so low?
And on the flip side, we got the call from Lynn, who said, you know, she was working in construction, but it was untenable with childcare, you know, to have to be at the job site at 7:30. And she was saying, I don't see a reason why that has to be that way. I mean, is that, Meg Smith, the kind of thing that we were talking about earlier with businesses thinking about how to be more friendly to all kinds of employees, which may include people who are taking care of small children?
Exactly. I thought that was a really great example of how a shift in shifts could help workers in the state. So it is understanding kind of the needs and the ebbs and flows of families and, you know, what women need in order to be able to have a job in the skilled trades, for example. That was really great. You have great listeners, great callers.
Yes, that we know. Let's hear one more here from Chris in Wallingford. Hi, Chris. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
So my observation is that it seems to me that in many cases, women don't feel entitled to negotiate for higher wages when they're in a position to negotiate for wages. And I wondered, one, is there data to support that? And two, what kind of support and training can we give to women so that they do negotiate for the wages that they're worth?
Thank you for the call. What about that? What about this idea of women? I mean, we do hear this all the time. And is it just anecdotal, or is there some proof that women don't negotiate as well or aren't as comfortable negotiating salary increases?
There is data to suggest that women are less likely to negotiate, and also that when they do negotiate, they get not as good results. They don't get as much extra money out of it. The Commission on Women, in partnership with Norwich University, just did a training for college women called Start Smart, which is a program of the American Association of University Women. And that is an example of one training. It was a one-shot training that can give women a few very concrete tools that they can use to negotiate and encourage them to do so. It's a scary thing if you've never done it before, and it's not something that comes naturally to everybody. And so some specific training and developing those skills is very helpful.
But are they less likely to be then successful because they're not doing it well, or because employers feel like they don't have to give them the increase they've asked
for? Well, isn't that a good question? There is evidence that there is sometimes a backlash when women negotiate. Sometimes we feel, I don't want to negotiate because I'm afraid that they won't like me and they'll think I'm hard to work with and I'm trouble. And there's some evidence that that is actually true sometimes. So that's obviously a much deeper problem that we have to work with, but it should not stop us from negotiating anyway.
Meg Smith, we've been talking today as two of the reports from Change the Story have come out, Women, Work, and Wages in Vermont, and Where Vermont Women Work and Why It Matters. And we have links to both at vpr.net. But what's next for Change the Story? What else are you working on?
Well, there are two more reports coming up, one on women-owned businesses, where there's a lot of mixed data, whether we do very well in Vermont with women-owned businesses or that we are at the bottom of the barrel. And then the final report is going to be on women in leadership and where we stand on women on corporate boards and where women stand as leaders in the state. So it's going to be new information. And then really taking these reports and going out and talking about them with people and having those conversations carry out on their own. Part of this work is not to just issue reports, and it's also not for Change the Story to be the only one leading this change and telling these stories. It's for, like the Business Peer Exchange, to continue to multiply and go out in every county in Vermont and not just in one county itself. So we're really excited about that. And that's kind of what the whole Vermont Women's Fund, as the lead funder, is pushing for. This is what philanthropy does best, which is help social initiatives move forward. It's no longer in the public and private sector. So we're very excited to work with the Commission on Women and Vermont Works for Women to keep this going and to keep telling this story and seeing how we can make change.
Well, two powerful women leaders in Vermont here with us today. I want to thank you. Carrie Brown is Executive Director of the Vermont Commission on Women, and Meg Smith is Director of the Vermont Women's Fund. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jane.
As I said, you can find more information about Change the Story, including links to the two reports that have been put out already at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Coming up, why is the Augusta St. Gaudens National Historic Site in New Hampshire trying to find some living Vermonters who might have a connection to a statue of Abraham Lincoln? We'll find out next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Augusta St. Gaudens National Historic Site in Cornish, New Hampshire, is getting a new cast of one of the great sculptor's most famous works, the monumental Standing Lincoln. It turns out the man who posed for the statue, and it wasn't Abraham Lincoln, was a Vermont man named Langdon Morse. And now the site is looking for living relatives of Morse. We're joined now by Henry Duffy, curator at the St. Gaudens National Historic Site. Henry, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This statue, which I called Standing Lincoln, is known in two ways. It's known as Standing Lincoln, but it's also more formally known as Abraham Lincoln the Man. What does the original St. Gaudens statue, which is in Chicago, Illinois, in Lincoln Park, actually look like?
Well, it gets its shorter name because it is a standing figure of the 16th president. St. Gaudens actually made two Lincolns, one sitting and one standing, and they're both in Chicago, and both within about a block of each other. So it just became convenient for people to call one the Standing Lincoln and one the Sitting Lincoln. But the one that we're going to be bringing back here is the one that actually shows the president who has arisen from a very formal, classical-looking chair of state, and he's actually he's moving forward into our space. So he's showing that he is a Republican leader with a small r. I should say that in an election year, but a Republican with a small r, but although he was a Republican with a large r, too. But he's reaching out, that he's not a king, so he's not on a throne, but he's stepping forward. And in fact, the statue, the left foot is actually a little bit off the pedestal, so it really looks as if he's moving forward.
Yeah, as you said, he's coming into the space. It's sort of Lincoln in motion. And it's a very large statue. You have a picture on your website of the sculptor, St. Gaudens, standing next to the statue, and he's dwarfed by Lincoln.
Yes. The statue is 12 feet tall, and the base is 6 feet. So it's quite a large piece. And that's not uncommon in monumental sculpture like this for this sort of park setting, and it's not vanity; it's a necessity, because when you get a bronze sculpture outdoors, it suddenly looks tiny. So you have to make it bigger to make it seen.
So, Henry, you're building a new cast of this statue and installing it on your grounds, and it's a really involved process, which you've been chronicling, again, at the St. Gaudens National Historic Site website, which is very cool. And when St. Gaudens was creating this sculpture, that was a really involved process, too. And he was very particular at the time about getting a man who looked like Lincoln to be his model, since the real Lincoln had died 20 years earlier. So why did Augustus St. Gaudens move to Cornish, New Hampshire, and how did he find his muse?
Well, he actually came because his attorney, a man named Charles Beeman from New York, promised him that if he came up here to New Hampshire, he'd find many Lincoln-shaped men. And it's one of the most wonderful quotes from our story here. But that's why he came. And he came up in March. He came on the train from Manhattan with his wife. And I have to say that coming in mud season is not the best time to see New England, especially if you're not used to New England. And he came up and looked around and was ready to go back to the train quickly. And his wife said, no, I think let's take a look. So they looked at a house that Beeman had available for them. He had bought, Beeman had bought a series of farms in the area, and the houses were empty. He was trying to fill them with his friends. So they came and looked at the house here in Cornish, and Mrs. St. Gaudens liked it. Augustus didn't think it was going to work, but she persuaded him to come back in the summer, and he found that she was right, that he worked beautifully here, in not just because the atmosphere is so wonderful here in our neck of the woods, but also because he was not disturbed.
Well, and because of those Lincoln-shaped men that he could find here.
And we wish we knew how he met Langdon Morse, but Langdon Morse was a justice of the peace and actually a town councilor and a Vermont state legislator. He lived in Windsor, Vermont, right across the river from us. And somehow, we don't know how, the two met, and St. Gaudens realized that that was the man he wanted. And once he found him and convinced the man to be the model, he went to work. And St. Gaudens was known for his obsession with detail on these things. He managed to find Abraham Lincoln's tailor and had an exact duplicate suit made so that the model would be wearing essentially the very clothes that the president would wear. And then he had the model walk around all over town and through the woods and everything to get the clothes lived in so that they didn't look like a stiff new suit, and they didn't look like a costume. He wanted them to look as if it was something that somebody was actually wearing. He then did something else, which is really remarkable. He engaged another local man, G.E. Knowlton, also from Windsor, who was a photographer, to come and take many, many pictures. And nowadays, that wouldn't seem like much of anything, but in 1885, that was big news. That was a very unusual thing to do. And he took not only standing and sitting shots, front and back and all that, but he took details of hands, arms, knees, whatever, so that St. Gaudens could have all that as reference to work from when the model wasn't there. So,
and Henry, I want to jump you ahead because we just have a minute left, and I love this. And we should say St. Gaudens actually did use a mask of the real Lincoln's face to complete his statue, but he had Deacon Morse, Langdon Morse, as the sort of body double for Lincoln.
Right.
And now you're actually looking for relatives of Langdon Morse. Why?
Because we'd like to finish the story. We're historians here. We'd love to know more about Morse. We know a little bit about him, but we'd love to know more about his life and what happened afterwards. Did anyone know that he had been the model for the sculpture? Did anything change? Did he ever have anything to do with artists again? That would be fascinating to know. So if anyone has any knowledge of him or of Knowlton, the photographer, we'd love to know it.
That's Henry Duffy. He's curator at the St. Gaudens National Historic Site in Cornish, New Hampshire. And if you think you have a tip for him or maybe even a connection to Langdon Morse, you can find a link to contact the historic site at vpr.net. Henry, thank you so much for talking with us and good luck.
Thank you.
Now, Vermont is rife with authors and artists, but we also have an amazing collection of noted cartoonists. So as the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction gets ready to celebrate its 10th anniversary, we'll check in with a trio of Vermont cartoonists tomorrow on Vermont Edition. They'll discuss cartooning in the digital age and the local cartooning community. You can send your questions or comments to vermontedition@vpr.net, and be sure to tune in for that tomorrow at noon. Our program is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.